Hello and welcome to Misbehave, the podcast where we explore human behavior in a business context. Season 2 of Misbehave is all about uncovering behavioral patterns which create success in life and business. We're joined by highly driven, accomplished individuals to assess their behavioral patterns and dive into how behaviors have influenced their journey. In this episode, we chat with Rachel Harris, a disruptor in the accounting world and co-founder of Strivex. We talk about everything from using data to drive business decisions, the impact of building an authentic personal brand, and the strategies she employs on a day-to-day basis in scaling her business and challenging the norms of her industry. Well, welcome, Rachel. We're so excited to have you with us. It feels like this has been a long time in the making. So I'm going to dive in with a bit of a provocative question, I suppose. I know you've done Myers-Briggs in the past, and it branded you as introverted. And obviously, when we were talking about the high-level nature of profiling tools like that and how often they can give you this badge that you feel like you're in a box with. We're going to get into some of your behaviours, but just talk us through, what was your impression when you heard that? Where did it feel like it resonated? Where did it feel like it didn't? And yeah, what was your experience with that?
So I feel like, as an accountant, I am not unfamiliar with a stereotype. And when I did Myers-Briggs, if you put the Myers-Briggs results into like a careers generator, it literally tells you to become an accountant. So like, as an introverted, sensitive person who loves analyzing data, but also has quite strong soft skills, it literally told me to become an accountant. And I feel like a lot of my life changed when I took the blinkers off myself of just calling myself an accountant. And so after I'd been an accountant for 6 or 7 years, after I qualified, I started doing an MBA. And that MBA was like the pivotal turning point in my career, where I feel like I'd attached those labels all of the way from school, from being a young girl who just loved maths, but was like scared to talk about that because it was nerdy and not cool, and it meant that boys wouldn't want to go out with me, all of the way through to just really loving data, loving business, loving like really strong analytical skills that helped me in all areas of my life, whether it's dealing with like complex emotions. I feel like I can break it down and reconcile those things and find comfort with that. And so I think for me, these profiling tools can be fantastic as benchmarks and guidelines, but I think very, very often they need to be delivered in a really kind way that helps people to understand that it can change and it can grow with you. But also it can be, I feel like sometimes I put myself in the box of being an introvert, and actually I felt like it limited me in a way. And so, yeah, my life changed when I saw it as a guideline and not a rule.
I think that's so fascinating. And it's the thing that we feel so passionate about. And obviously we have a tool as part of the work that we do with managers. But I think even outside of that, it's about those, I have a bit of an issue with those tools that put you into four brackets, because as you've just so eloquently described, as humans, we're so much more complex than four labels and four badges. And what was really interesting for us when we looked at your profile and we looked at all the 18 different areas that we look at, actually only two of them aligned with the introvert badge. So the fact that you prefer to work more independently and will probably thrive and be more productive when you can get your head down. And I think the bit that resonated with me when I was reading that about you was the monk mode that you do on a morning. I'm sure that is so that you feel like you get ahead in your day before all of the interruptions happen. So yes, that aligns more with an introverted behavior. And then you're slightly more internal, which means that you internalize things. You will work on what you think is best, which often layers through to that introvert piece. But there are so many other behaviors that just doesn't align with that. And that shows us, I suppose, that four-dimensional part of you that just isn't able to be as well described when you look at just four areas. You know, your high, your drive for action, you actually don't have those detail and procedural traits that often an introverted accountant would align with. So it was fascinating to see that actually sometimes those personality tools will profile you in one area, but they give you such a high level overview that it can't give you the depth underneath. That maybe felt like when you read some of that, you resonated with it on one side, but actually there's this whole other piece of you that was yet to be discovered.
100%. And I think sometimes as an accountant, I run the business with my husband, James, married to the world's sexiest accountant. And we say all of the time that as an accountant, we've got 770 clients and we see like all of these different personality types and like skills and traits come out in people. And the really, really successful people normally work in a partnership with somebody else. And I feel like me and James accidentally became good business owners because I am actually not the world's best accountant. I'm a great visionary and James is a great implementer. And so between the two of us, I do lots of the like alone work to get projects started and get them finished. And actually James will take them away and do the like really heavy data, technical, implementary things. And I feel like actually very often, I wish all business partners had to do this stuff at the very beginning, because you'd be able to like spot quite quickly if issues were going to come up, what is the skill set that they are missing between the two of them?
Yeah, it's the strengths and the blind spots. But I just want to pick up on the fact that you talked about being given a label. And this is something that is often the case when people receive the information, they'll give themselves a label. Now, sometimes that can be used for positive and sometimes it can be used for a negative. Like they give themselves that and almost think, well, that's what I am and I'm not going to be able to do anything about that. The way that we like to say it, and I'm just saying this for the listeners really, is that it's really about understanding what your strengths are, what your blind spots are with our behavioral tool. Flipping the lid off the box, the sides down, and being able to flex back and forward. So when you're interacting with other people, you can flex depending on them and their behaviors, makes you less judgmental about the differences between you and them. But also you can understand that you don't have to stay like that rigid all of the time. If you can understand yourself better and the people around you, suddenly you're able to flex to get much better interactions.
If you're interested in learning more about your own management behaviours and the behaviours of your team, click the link in the show notes to access a 14-day free trial of Perform.
I know that you've studied sort of the business psychology side. How did you use that learning and ongoing learning since then to be able to take the behavioural and human behaviour insight stuff to manage your team better and also interact with your clients better?
As an accountant, like as a very data-driven girly, was really like not that engaged in Myers-Briggs and the organizational behavior module of my MBA at the very beginning. Like when I read the brief of the course, I just thought, oh, this is just one of the ones that I'm just going to have to do and not enjoy. And it was the most transformative module for me. Even, you know how people like accidentally discover yoga or like accidentally discover mindfulness? Like that's how I felt like it was for me. That was never a class that I would have signed up for, but I absolutely loved it. And I went on to my assignment that I submitted for that module. I went on and that was my first TED talk. So I did a TED talk on how to scale a high performance team as an introvert, because I think very, very often introverts or people who sit quite heavy on the data side of life actually in pop culture are showcased as the Sheldon Coopers of the world. We are not the main character. We're normally the butt of a joke. It's either the IT department or the accountant in films and programs and things that we see on TV. And so actually what's really, really important is I think my job as an employer is actually really helping our team turn the volume up on the bits of their personality that actually a lot of pop culture from a very young age is showcased to us as like quite nerdy and quite like unattractive, or like, I mean, I, again, married an accountant, so very attractive to me, but like very, very often that pop culture element is really, really important in the same way that like Barbie is also consuming this information is too. And so I think for me, a lot of my job as an employer is A, rebranding it. Like I think I would love for the accounting industry to be measured before and after me in terms of impact, the stereotype. If someone closed their eyes and imagined what an accountant looked like, it hopefully wouldn't be a stale, pale male with brown carpet anymore. It would be someone who is incredibly talented, really bloody intelligent, and actually just operates and supports businesses at another level. And so, yeah, I guess from my perspective, acknowledging it is really important, but also making sure that people feel really proud to do that as well.
And disrupting the marketplace. I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think some of what you're saying there, without using the words,
plays into that piece that I know is so core to your business around values, and those values internally with people, but also with clients. And it's one of these conversations that we have a lot with, obviously we work in workplace and culture, and often we get these questions of, okay, well, values are all great, and you see all of the team-related things that you want to see from values. You know, you get people are more engaged, people have better team dynamics, they're able to really see their purpose and what they're working towards. But often values, when it comes to clients, is tricky. Because, listen, let's face it, when we're ever asked to forgo revenue or lose a sale or get rid of a long-standing client, that is often looked at as, well, that's going to hit the bottom line. So actually, do we want to uphold a value here, or do we want to keep the monetary reward at the other end? Can you give us some examples of how those values come into play for you, specifically with customers, and whether or not you've ever had some of those difficult decisions to make of maybe somebody not to work with, obviously don't name any names, or that you've had to get rid of a client, or and how you approached those decisions?
I would love to. This is especially juicy, just in case anyone's listening, because you guys are a client of ours.
There you go. Don't fire us.
So we do not niche. 4 years ago, we were a one-man band on our dining room table, and we just had this huge desire to align everybody through values. So I recruit, hire and fire on the same business, on the same basis that I do decide which clients that we work with and continue to work with. I did a lot of my training at a top 100 firm where clients were allowed to be quite rude to you. Clients were allowed to, especially as a young female, like I would turn up to clients and they'd look through me saying, sorry, I can't talk to you. I'm waiting for my accountant. And I had to awkwardly explain that I was the accountant that they were waiting for. And very often if you escalated it, or if you said like, I just have impending doom every time I see this person's name in my inbox or on my phone, the partner would look at the fee value or the profit margin before they decided what to do about it. And it just always felt so backwards to me. And I feel like as an employer, lots of people say, wow, a lot with our benefits package and the way that we treat the team and the fact that we're values driven. And to me, none of it's wow. Like it's all just very basic common sense. And being an employer, remembering what it was like to be an employee. And so with values, our core focus as a business is to become the accounting firm of choice for celebrities, influencers, and business owners who are aligned by a desire to feel better about their finances. And so whenever we take on a client, within our proposal, there's a whole section on core values. And so you accept our core values when you accept our proposal. Our core values are also in our letter of engagement, which is a legal document that you sign. And so we expect you to uphold the same values that we measure our team against as well. That's really important. I think sometimes it's a bit of a Marmite situation. Some people are like, oh, our number one core value is don't be a dick. And I actually find that generally the only people that would be put off by that are people who intend to behave like a dick. Like if you saw that core value, you'd be like, great. I love that. It means I'm not going to be spoken to in a way that makes me feel uncomfortable. It sets the tone that like we do a very serious job, but I don't take myself too seriously, and that everybody comes to work or engages with financial services to just feel good. And so we really heavily implement it into our onboarding process, expectation setting, and letter of engagement. But also we uphold that internally as well. And so our core values are brought into every single appraisal process. We score people on core values 0 to 5. So they come to every appraisal with examples of how they score themselves and examples of how they've implemented core values at each touch point with their different clients. And so us doing that internally and externally also gives us the opportunity to, because of my experience of seeing clients not uphold the same values that I was measured against, we have built a custom field on our CRM software, which gives every single member of staff the ability to red flag a client. So if you are a member of staff and a client books a meeting with you more than once and doesn't turn up with no explanation, or they don't speak to you in a very nice way, like you get the heebie-jeebies when you see their name in your inbox, you can red flag the client. Or it could be that like every single year or at every single touch point, the client pays the fees but just really grumbles about it. We get some of them sometimes where they're happy to pay, they just want you to know that it's expensive. And so any member of the team can red flag a client at any time. And then once a month, as preparation for our board meeting, our head of compliance reviews every single new addition to the red flag list, and we decide whether or not to disengage or continue to work with them. But at each touch point, the clients are spoken to. And so we have three different sort of like templated comms that we send out. One actually warns the client that somebody has red flagged them. We give them an explanation of why and actually explain why that's not acceptable within the firm. My favorite one is if someone has been quite outrightly rude, is we ask them to apologize to the team member or disengage.
Oh, I love that.
Love it.
The third is just a flat out disengage. And again, you are clients and you hearing me explain that process will just be a green flag to you because you don't plan on ever being a red flag. And finances are stressful, taxes are stressful. Like there are genuine situations where somebody being really frustrated or stressed is completely acceptable. However, like we're all human beings and no team member should ever come to work to be spoken to in a way that actually like just makes them feel really bad. And so uncomfortable conversations are great to have at work and you can be very kind rather than being nice in those conversations. But outrightly being rude is, yeah.
Can I just share an example of where I think that comes into play for you, where aside from the red flag bit, but the green flag bit, I got an email from one of your team who actually offered to reduce our fees on something because she felt like the original proposal actually proposed for more items, and when she'd gone through and done stuff, it was less. So she was like, just so you know, in upcoming periods, it will cost less. And I was like, I have never, I don't think ever, had a supplier offer for me to pay them less. And I think that just shows that values piece, not just because I think often organizations can sometimes fall into the trap of doing values when it works for them. So you know what, we'll hire by values when we've got enough candidates to choose from,
or when people are performing well.
Exactly. Or when people are performing well. Or, but you know what, if we've only got one candidate and we need the job filled, we'll hire them even if we feel like they're not. Or we'll uphold values with clients when it works for us, but we won't reciprocate when it doesn't. And I think that's a really great example of where you hold people accountable, but you also hold yourselves accountable.
I feel like as well, it's like transparency is very important to me. So like integrity and transparency, I'd say are my personal core values. And again, a lot of the stuff within our firm that other people are like, wow, is the stuff that when I was an employee, I was like, wow. And for me, pay was one of them. And so we have a completely transparent pay matrix, but we also have a completely transparent fee matrix. So at every single touch point and every single piece of work, we will just be reconciling the volume and complexity of your transactions with things like turnover with our fee matrix. And at every touch point, the team follow the process to make sure that's reviewed in the same way that every single time someone passes an exam or they hit a service award, their pay is increased. Actually, they are really strongly incentivized to make sure that the fees are increased or decreased in this case too. But that transparency works both ways as well, because the trust you would have gained from her saying they go down, but it's also set your expectation that if things change, it can go up or down.
Yeah, yeah.
For sure. I think we kind of live by a similar thing. We've definitely done that with clients before. But I think what's really lovely about what you do is that you actually set it out in the first instance from the offset. And I think that's where we see a lot of people don't do. They think it's almost an unspoken thing. Like, we're going to charge you, right? We're fair. We're going to, you know, we're going to let you know if things change, or we'll respond. Like, they're things that sometimes are almost seen as unspoken, but actually sometimes they do need to be laid out so that those unspoken things don't get forgotten about or gone against without people really knowing they're doing it. And you've also got a benchmark to be able to hold people accountable to, clients and internally. And you know, we're massive advocates of that, because that's why we love the behavioral work, because you can actually say these are certain, you know, the values underlie the behaviors, sit underneath the values, and you're like, these are the kind of almost your code of conduct. Then you can hold someone accountable and have that difficult conversation way easier because you've laid it out in the first instance. Whereas if you didn't, the difficult conversation would suddenly become an absolute nightmare, and you know, a lot of people would just not bother having it because it's easier not to. I'm interested, Rachel, you, for the listeners, you're pretty high energy. They can't see you, but you're high energy, you know, and obviously that's kind of how you attack life and attack the business. I'm interested to know, what have you learned about sort of the benefits of slowing down and speeding up when you need to? What are your strategies for that?
Slowing down, I can't tell you. Yeah, I definitely would categorize myself as like a high achieving type A productive personality type. I don't drink, I don't smoke, and I say to my husband all of the time, I think I'm addicted to running the business, because I love solving problems. Like, I genuinely believe I was always meant to be a business owner and not an accountant. And my role now, I'm quite removed from the day-to-day running of the firm. And actually, my job is to make sure that our business runs as a business and not as an accounting firm. Like, lots of incredible accountants start accounting firms because they can do accounts. And actually, normally, maybe past 10 employees, the wheels fall off because it's not actually a business. It's a old-fashioned, portfolio-driven accounting firm. And so my job, we're currently at £1.5 million. We've got 20 team members across two offices. And my job is to make sure the business runs as a business. And so a lot of that is continuously asking for feedback. So we use data to do that. We do net promoter scoring, and we have employee net promoter scoring, which pulse surveys every 7 days, the whole team. And so I'd say I use data a lot of the time to drive really like high performance decisions that also calm a lot of my anxiety. I think one of the things, I think part of being quite a strong type A personality is quite high anxiety that goes with that. And I think they're almost two parts of the same thing. And so I use data very often to inform decisions or help me to make decisions that actually otherwise I might feel quite anxious doing. I'd say my whole life operates at 110%. So I feel it's quite a hard question.
But I think that data answer is really interesting, because we obviously believe in that from a management perspective. And I think it's something that not enough people do. There's too much, and I'm all for intuition and gut, right, in terms of making decisions. But I think we have definitely seen a shift of people saying, oh, well, I just lead intuitively, or I run the business intuitively. And that's great in terms of trust your gut for whether something's right or wrong. But actually, don't then think that data is the devil, because actually the data is going to tell you something. And that's why we're such fans of the behavioral piece of, like, manage your team with data, right? Manage them based on the behavioral makeup and what percentages they score in different areas. It's going to give you the data to be able to manage them more intelligently, as would a business scorecard if you were looking across your organization that'll tell you whether you're on or off track. Use that data so that then enables you to have the right conversations in the right places, to be able to drive the right outcomes, versus just this, oh, I just intuitively know if it's right or wrong. Because as you rightly said, as you scale, if you're not involved in every area of the business, you can't possibly, your intuition can't touch everything, and you may well lose some things there. So, and it's interesting that you figured that out, because in your, obviously you've got an analytical mind from a perspective of accountancy, but actually from a behavioral perspective, you're 100% big picture. So you're true visionary, 100% goal orientated, 90% initiation. And actually it's that often can drive that not slowing down, not looking at things, not looking at the data. So it's almost that you've balanced that. How conscious have you had to be with that, Rachel, do you think?
So it's really interesting, because I feel like a lot of the parts that require stopping and looking, I have had to like process into the business to make myself do it. Otherwise I just wouldn't do it. So things like board meetings, we have board meetings once a month, which is me and my husband, but also we have an external board seat, which is just a non-exec board member who doesn't work in the business, but helps us work on it. And so implementing board meetings is really good. And I completely agree with what you said about intuition versus data. And I feel like being able to work with such a broad scope of business owners in all of the different formats that they come in, because being a business owner can look like my life looks, but it can also look like someone who's just come off Love Island and has a massive following and is going to manage. Like, being a business owner looks very different to lots of people. And actually, one thing that brings everybody together is there will always be an element of the business that you feel like is a weakness to you. And I feel like my job is using data to help you to sleep at night with the bit of the business that you feel uncomfortable with. And so an example is that we had a manager within our firm who, my gut, like, everything in my body told me that the core value scoring wasn't right. And again, like most things with people, this came out, like, I was starting to feel it after about 6 to 12 months. And being able to sleep at night when you employ 20 people, whilst also look after the volume of clients that we do, you have to be able to rely on things that aren't your tummy to tell you the answers, literally to make sure that you're not doubting yourself. And so that's where our ENPS scoring system came in. And so what I felt like was happening in my tummy, the data told me was exactly true. And so our managers are KPI'd on not only the happiness of the clients, the Google reviews, the NPS scoring, but also they are KPI'd on the happiness and the feedback of their team. And so our team anonymously through NPS scoring were telling us exactly what I thought to be true was right. And so we were able to performance manage him, and we helped him to find a job that was right for him. Like, he had such incredible skill sets, they just weren't the skill sets that aligned with our team. And so I feel like very often that decision could have been a decision that I looked back on now, because he's such a nice guy, like we got on so well. It could very easily be a decision that I looked back on and thought, like, did I make the right decision? And so actually, I feel like doing things like this is really important to help you identify your weak spots. And for me, I'm a bit of a people pleaser. Like, making a decision to ask, like, to find someone else another job is really hard. And like, that's definitely something that I would lose sleep over. But by putting these things in place and understanding your weaknesses, it can really, really help you to feel confident making those decisions.
It's like taking the guesswork out of it, isn't it?
It's that combination of the intuition and the data is amazing.
Yeah. And taking the guesswork out, but also helping you then look back and know you've made the right decision. Because sometimes as a business owner, you make decisions, you think that's right, but then you can get that awful creep afterwards, you know, looking back thinking, goodness, did I? Particularly if it impacts revenue or impacts your client base. So I think sometimes that it's the data giving you the insight that can give you that reassurance post it, but also just take the guesswork out, because we will create narratives subconsciously around a situation, and you may go to someone else, like your husband, for his thought or chain of thought, but actually getting a more collective viewpoint on things is super important. You've obviously built a really strong sort of personal brand. What piece of advice would you give to other people looking to do the same in their space or in their field?
As part of our benefits package, I do one-to-one personal development with every member of our team for a year. And we really encourage our team to build their own personal brands, to start posting on social media, telling their own story. And I feel like building a personal brand is building an asset that will always be yours. No one will ever take that away from you. So if someone built a personal brand while they worked at our firm and then they went on to start their own firm, it would be a brilliant firm. And they'd also have a strong personal brand that was associated with me. And people would expect that standard of them as well. And so the first thing is that it's an asset that no one will ever be able to take away from you. But secondly, in this conversation I was having with the team member, we were talking about posting and it feeling uncomfortable. And she said to me, personal branding is icky until you're you. Like, no one likes doing it until you've got 100,000 followers. Nobody likes doing it until you're doing TED Talks. Nobody likes doing it until you've been featured in Forbes. Like, it feels horrible until you're you. And so, which I obviously found hugely embarrassing. And so I feel like the one thing I would say is that feeling never goes away. If anything, it gets bigger.
Because you've then got a bigger network, haven't you?
Yeah, got more eyeballs watching, more people commenting on LinkedIn saying, you need to check your numbers. And I feel like for me, you'll always be too much for someone. And actually, they should be going and finding less. It shouldn't be about you turning the volume down on yourself. And so a really big part of my story and the reason that my personal brand is very strong and very pink and very much like soft and fluffy in my personality type is because at so many points in my career, I was told I was too much. And I was told that I'd never be a good leader because I was soft and fluffy. And one manager literally said to me, you are on a planet that like rainbows and unicorns live on, and you'll never be a good leader because you don't have that strength inside of you. And so the reason my personal brand is so strong is because it is like for all of the children that had childhoods like mine, where they either felt too much or like they didn't belong, or I came from a very low income household. And so children like me didn't go into professional services, and I had to wear my school shoes and my school trainers to my apprenticeship because I couldn't afford to buy workwear. And so much of it is not only about me and my career, but also like for everybody else that comes after me to see that be held open. And so attaching it to something that's more important than how uncomfortable you feel can really, really help you, because for me, a lot of what I do is not for me, it's for other people.
And I think that is probably one of the most impactful ways to position personal brand that I've heard, in terms of you can see that with you if people follow you and if you don't do, we'll link your socials. But, you know, doing things like you fund people to do their AAT, and I think that you having that authenticity and that story and that thread running through everything is so important. And I think that's often where the personal brand thing gets mixed up, that people maybe don't find that driving force behind their personal brand. So it actually just becomes this thing that, let's face it, social media can feel very surface level a lot of the time. And I think if you haven't got that real depth to why you're doing something, you will give up in the moments where it feels surface level, or in the moments where you're really busy and you're like, I don't have time to write a LinkedIn post today. So I think that's a really lovely, a lovely way to describe it.
And it's always amazing how many people are watching, even if you don't see them engaging, or like you are planting seeds in people. So we're now 4 years on. 20 team members, and four of our team members became accountants because they found my content. They were looking for careers advice online and couldn't work out what they wanted to do as a job, and were watching my YouTube videos like how to become an accountant or how to decide if you should be an accountant, and we've now recruited them as accountants. And so again, it feels icky until you see that stuff happen, but like people are always watching. Even if you think they're not, people are always watching.
I'm interested to pivot a little bit, because obviously one of the things that you talk a lot about, Rachel, which I think is not talked about enough in the accountancy space, unless you are a £200 million business and you're working with one of the big four, is scaling your business and funding. And I think a lot of accountants don't have the knowledge or the know-how that they should have. Unless you are, like I say, a bigger business where you're looking maybe for venture capital or something like that. But, and we've obviously had some experience of this recently with our own scale journey. But talk to us a little bit about some of the ways that you've seen organizations that are smaller achieve strong growth through alternative methods of funding, whether that's bootstrapping, whether that's angel investment, whether that's debt funding, outside of this, the whole VC. Will, talk to us a little bit about some of that.
So I feel like, again, pop culture is back at us again, because shows like Dragon's Den or Shark Tank or even Instagram will make angel investment or venture capital seem very, very sexy. And it sets this tone that the only way for your business to have a value is to sell part of it to somebody else. And I sit on the opposite of the sexy spectrum in many areas of my life, but also in valuing your business. And our business is a great example of a bootstrapped business. So being bootstrapped just means that you are funding the business through its ongoing profit generation, and you're not investing or selling part of your business to get cash injections from anywhere else. And so we have scaled from a dining room table up to a 20-person firm, especially in an industry where lots of our competitors will outsource work to other countries who can operate at much lower labor margins, where they don't have minimum wages or very, very low thresholds of minimum wages. And so to be very values driven in this industry and be bootstrapped very much sits on the unsexy part of the landscape. But on the other end of the landscape is angel investment, venture capital. And so one of the coolest bits of my job is the high level consulting work that I do. And so I get to work with businesses before, during, and after going on shows like Dragon's Den and Shark Tank, or before, during, and after angel investment and venture capital investment. And in 2023, facilitated over £10 million worth of investments into businesses. And I'm a really, really strong believer that regardless of where the cash is coming from and how your business is scaling, having a strong understanding of the value of your business can improve many areas of your business. For example, on the hard days, understanding how much your business is worth can really help you almost reconcile how hard it feels. Running a business is one of the hardest things I've ever done. I'm not a parent, and so I can't compare it, but like it is the hardest thing I have ever done.
I am a parent, and I can tell you it's still one of the hardest things I've done.
literally one of the hardest things I've ever done. And one of the most important things is that you can't pass a job down to your children, and you can't sell a job, but you can pass a business down to your children, and you can sell a business. And so having an understanding of the difference between the profit extraction that you're taking from the business and the value that sits within the business separately is really important. Because on the hard days, not only do I know that I'm getting paid, I also know that I have an asset that I could sell at any time. So that can really help firstly. And you can see how if you're bootstrapped, you plan to exit one day, or you're just considering different options, having an intrinsic value of your business can help you to make very good decisions and help you to reconcile it on the hard days.
I suppose the smaller end of funding, things like angel investment, really help scale a business. And almost what advice you would give to people who are going through that process currently?
So my first challenge would be to really, really dig deep on what it is that you need. Lots of people think that cash will solve their problems. There are actually very few problems that can be solved by just cash. Normally you can scale faster, but unless you have an entirely perfect business model, cash can only solve a couple of problems. And so I'd really challenge you to think about, is it cash that you need? If so, go to a bank. Don't sell part of your business to somebody else. So with angel investment or venture capital funding, every percent of equity that you give away, you're giving away a penny of every single future pound of profit that you make. And that is worth so much to you as a business. So if you just need cash, can you exhaust other options that aren't selling part of your business? If it's not just cash, you're probably a great candidate for angel investment. And so angel investment is like what you see on Dragon's Den. That's where people go into the den, specifically targeting Stephen Bartlett, because he's got great marketing and scalable skills. It could be that they're targeting a different dragon who can help them get into Tesco's and Asda. And so that's a really great example of where it's capital plus investors, where you're looking for the capital plus something else. It's people who would make great board seats, advisors, they've got the strategy and the expertise to really help you. And so my biggest challenge is, what do you actually need? Is it cash and a problem being solved? In which case, angel investment is fantastic. Is it just cash? Go to a bank. If it's just cash and you don't have existing business traction to help you get a loan, there could be other things, especially as like in the British economy, even post the autumn budget, there are really great incentives to help people to grow and scale businesses in the UK. So look at things like Innovate UK funding, any grant funding that's available to you, but really, really challenge yourself that angel investment isn't a shiny object that will solve all of your problems, and you need explicit clarity on what those problems are and who you need to solve them before you start.
I think that's great advice, because I think that's often not where people start. You know, they start by just looking at where's, they take advice, don't they, from people around them, or they look at how other people have done it, and you've never got any, you don't have any in-depth intel into why they went into it in the first place. I think that's really great advice.
Yeah, for sure. Rachel, tell us a little bit about your uniqueness outside of the business space. Tell us some things that maybe people don't know about you.
So I'm an identical twin. I feel like a lot of my life outside of work, when you hear about that story, you'll be like, oh, that's the way, like, that's why you are the way that you are. And so I'm an identical twin, and I'm 10 minutes older, so I'm very much an older sister. And my twin sister has quite severe learning and physical disabilities. She got poorly when we were babies, and so apart from the first 10 minutes of my life, I've had very strong caring responsibilities. And so I've always had this huge passion to help other people. It made me very outgoing at a very young age, because I had to be quite outspoken and like advocate for her needs and ask for things that she needed. And so, yeah, very much, there are a lot of things now that through therapy and through like really growing in confidence as a person, I can now look back at different things in my life and be like, oh yeah, that's the way that I am, the way that I am. And almost like untangling Christmas lights and being like, oh yeah, like they all connect together. And I thought it was just this mushy ball, but it's not, like everything led to the other. And so yeah, my sister is probably one of the biggest influences in my life. She causes me to work as hard as I do. I've seen somebody who was told that she'd never go to mainstream school or never get a job or never get married, like do all of those things. And so being able to see somebody repeatedly do things that people couldn't do, and it very much inspired the L Woods part of my life of what, like, it's hard. And so I feel like that has really driven a lot of my best personality traits, have come from watching someone I love overcome a lot of things that have been incredibly difficult, but through hard work and just inability to accept the word no has done a lot. And so yeah, that's a really, really big part of who I am outside of work, is my sister.
What a lovely way to wrap up. Thank you so much for joining us. We have really loved having you here with us.
You for having me, it's been amazing.
So let's wrap up with some takeaways from today's episode with Rachel. The first has to be around linking your personal brand to a cause or impact. We so often hear from leaders who are building personal brands that they dip out when it feels uncomfortable or when they look at social media and it feels very surface level. And really reflecting on what Rachel said about her own personal brand, usually that comes down to the fact that the cause behind your personal brand is not compelling enough. We talked then about data and how she uses data to not only make decisions, but to also cross-check her intuition. So obviously using that gut feel and that feeling in your tummy, as she put it, but using data to then back that up, then allows her to reduce the anxiety around some of those bigger decisions. And finally, we talked about funding and routes to scaling your business. And Rachel had some really interesting takeaways, specifically around taking the time to take a deep dive into what you really need the funding for. And be really careful that as you're going through that investment journey, if you're looking at VC funding, angel funding, bootstrapping, whatever that route for you is, making sure that you aren't just doing what other people have done and that you're really thinking deeply about what you need from that and what you need more than just the cash.
Thank you for listening to Misbehave. Follow us so you don't miss out on other episodes.